This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover-Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your own Splacavelli of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You're listening to Hard to Forget. It's the boy, Sam Hunt. Sam the Hunt. He is back. Southside, second album, 5 years after Montevallo. I gotta be honest, there are a few albums that I have been actively anticipating for as long or even one-tenth as long as I've been waiting for this Sam Hunt record. I wrote about Sam. I interviewed him. Piece came out about a week and a half ago. And just for a little backstory to let you know how much I care about Sam Hunt. Montevallo came out in 2015, and I had written about the EP that came out previously. So I didn't really write about Montevallo because I kind of had said everything I needed to say, but I knew I wanted to talk to him. I knew that there was a story, and I was like, okay, well, let's get the first story of the second cycle. And so I started making calls. I started having meetings, started having conversations. That was through 2016. And then 2017 rolls around and they're like, okay, he's in the studio, he's working. And we were going to do a thing where I checked in every 2-3 months throughout the process and then dropped a big piece when the record came. So I went to Nashville, went up to the house that he had not yet moved in with his fiance, his wife, where he was about to move in. So went up to the house where he lived with his bandmates. We had really, really good conversation. We probably had 2 big talks on that trip. And after that, nothing. I was like, this is weird. I couldn't quite figure out what had happened to Sam. And what had happened is he got his personal life together. He got married. He devoted time to his wife and to healing that relationship. It was Hannah, who is his wife, is the woman who he had been dating before he started becoming a country music star and had let go in order to become a country music performer. And he did the kind of ethical and responsible thing, which is put his career on a little bit of a slower path in order to make sure that he had gotten his life right before he got his career right. So I didn't hear from the Sam Hunt people for quite a long time. And then once they started trickling songs back out and it seemed very clear that the record was coming finally this year, a bunch more phone calls and a bunch more setup, and luckily was able to tie up that loose end and deliver the story. Persistence pays off. So this week on Popcast, we're going to talk about Sam. Natalie Weiner is going to call in, noted Sam Huntophile, and we're going to chat about Sam then and now. And then in part two, I'm going to talk about someone else who is a rule bender of country music, and that was Kenny Rogers. Kenny Rogers died a couple weeks ago, and I was thinking about the ways in which what Kenny did with country and pop in the late 70s through the mid 80s, not that different from what Sam has been doing with country and hip hop over the last 6 or 7 years. So Bill Friskix Warren is going to call in from Nashville to talk to me about Kenny Rogers' legacy. But first, you know, if you want to talk about Sam Hunt, you know who is on the other line. Natalie Weiner is here. Natalie.
Hi, John.
Yes, it's true. It's big facts. Big facts and bigger drip. Natalie is here. Natalie is a staff writer at SB Nation, though there are no sports.
It's true.
And of course, writes about music for Billboard and other publications. Sam Hunt is a frequent conversational topic between myself and Natalie, and has been for a long time.
He's just been looming, though. Sadly, you know, we've just been dealing with the ghost of Sam Hunt instead of the reality of Sam Hunt. And finally.
For frankly, me more than most, as someone that has been working and praying on this story for 3 years, 4 years, really. So Sam is back. You're writing about Southside. Tell me about your initial vibes on it. And how does it fit in the Hunt oeuvre?
Well, based on the singles, I wasn't super, super jazzed. You know, none of them really stuck out to me as bangers. Not even Body Like a Back Road, which I famously don't like.
Yes, we disagree on now. And to be fair, so you're talking about Body Like a Back Road. You're talking about Downtown's Dead.
And also, like, I mean, he released Sitting With You, right? Sooner. And the drinking.
Yes. Drinking Too Much. Although that totally feel like a single. That was a mixtape. That was, you know, that was the Lucy. And Kinfolks also.
Yes. Yes. And Kinfolks, obviously, which, you know, is the one that's at radio right now, I believe. None of them really had that, like, thing where I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to need to listen to this song 500 million times. But hearing the album all together, I was like, oh, this makes a lot more sense kind of as a unit.
Totally agree. Let me ask you a question that I asked Sam, or maybe even that Sam asked me, or somewhere in between.
Okay.
Do you think that people who liked Sam Hunt the first go around, and by the first go around, I mean kind of like the entirety of the 2014 to 2016 window, so kind of coming out of the mixtape into the EP, into the album, like the whole that arc. Do you think those people are people who crave country music innovation? Or what he did was access a kind of country music listener that maybe had not been adequately served by everybody else who was in the genre, but who already was kind of pre-existing.
I think definitely the latter.
Yeah.
I mean, I think just like his own origin story kind of speaks to that, you know, that he speaks candidly about how he grew up listening to like country music and rap music, you know, like in locker rooms, as it were, hashtag sports. But that's actually like a thing that I've encountered a lot just in my sports life, you know, like getting to know people from the rural South who I might not otherwise interact with. And like, yeah, that's their life. You know, I remember I did this story at the Super Bowl and I was just asking all the players like what their dream halftime show would be. This one player who was like, you know, D-list like member of the Patriots or something, but he's from Alabama. And he was like, I would pick like NBA Youngboy and Luke Bryan. That was his dream halftime show. And so I was like, wow. See, so that's the Sam Hunt listener.
Wow.
I don't remember if that was exactly it, but it was something along those lines.
Honestly, if that was a tour, I would be a deadhead on that tour.
Well, I know. So you just need to hang out in more football locker rooms, clearly, is what
I actually have another sports metaphor, which is something that I had thought about when I was talking to Sam. So to that point about making music for fans that already existed who had not been properly served, I really was thinking about it. Anybody who knows me and loves me know that I do not give mostly any kind of a rat's butt about sports, but I do know this one thing, and you as a sports writer can correct me if I am not right. You throw the football to where the receiver will be, not to where the receiver is.
Oh, and, wow. Oh, look at you. Okay. I see where this is going.
Okay. And the Sam and the Ecstasy EP and Montevallo are where the fans were already moving. It was the natural direction if you were to arc out the direction of young, interested country music listeners. That's where they were going.
Yeah.
All he did was he hit the pocket. That's it.
No, he didn't hit the pocket. He's in the pocket.
Oh, fine.
I was so close. No, the quarterback stands in the pocket. But yes, he was in the pocket. The receivers, the fans, they're running the route. They're already out there. He knows where they're going. And he's just hitting them right between the numbers.
Yes. And that, thank you, really, really brought it home. But to me, that was the kind of reason, like, I it's not that I don't think of Sam Hunt as an innovator, because I do. But I don't think that that's his primary appeal. And that's something that he and I spoke about a little bit, about like the level of innovation that he has to continue to have, or does not have to continue to have, you know, for the subsequent stages of his career. I think it was that there is this pre-existing country music listeners are already attuned, acclimated to this other pool of aesthetics. And him being someone who is naturally fluent on both sides, obviously can throw that pass and hit them. And frankly, in a way that Florida Georgia Line or Luke Bryan or any of these other folks never did. Like, I went back to read, I had done a country rap profile, kind of like scene piece, maybe the month that the Ecstasy EP came out. So we're talking like 2014, like early to mid 2014. And that piece, for the record, was late. I remember I had been working on it the previous year and had to shelve it for some reason or another. So that piece is already late. But all of that is to say, all that stuff was already happening. Cruise, the Cruise remix, Blake Shelton, Luke Bryan, even Justin Moore, like all that stuff was already happening, but it always felt false. It always felt pastiche and it always felt shticky. And then comes Sam Hunt and is like, this is cute that you guys are doing this. Let me tell you how this is really done.
I totally agree. I think it's just like he managed to integrate elements of hip hop in a way and R&B just in a way that's really, really subtle, frankly. And I think, honestly, it's like more obvious on Southside than it was on Montevallo.
Yes.
It was a lot more intentional and like coherent the way he did it throughout the whole project. Like it's all underscored by like not a trap beat. I'm not going to say that, but the same kind of syncopation that you find in a trap beat. Like that's grounding almost the entire project.
Yeah. And like, again, these are very conscious choices about we're using drum machines, you know, we're using, we're not using live drums. Like even that thing that to us is like a pretty nothing choice for people who listen across genre and who are our ears are trained on hip hop drums and pop music production choices. But if you compare it to other Nashville productions, it's it qualifies as a little bit radical. Although you did mention R&B, and I do, there is one song on Southside that I do think it's probably not going to get enough attention, so we should probably play just a bit of it. It's called Nothing Lasts Forever. It's a really good, like Sam and I talked a lot about R&B, and it's a really, really good R&B song that is a country song, but is actually an R&B song. But yeah, let's listen to a little Nothing Lasts Forever.
Tell me you feel sorry for me. Tell me you feel stupid. Tell me you feel lonely. Tell me you feel something for me. Cause nothing lasts forever.
So again, on this record, I agree that Southside does feel maybe a little bit more coherent, but I do feel that I'm hearing him playing to a bunch of different constituencies on this record. A couple songs after Nothing Lasts Forever is that song Breaking Up Was Easy in the 90s. And Breaking Up Was Easy in the 90s seems like the smarter version of a song that maybe he would have written and then like sold to like Dan and Shay or, you know,
Let's not go that low.
You know, Luke Combs. Fine. Yeah. You know, you tell me, you know, who
I
else?
Know. I know. I know what you mean.
Kit Moore, Charlie Worsham. You know, I don't know. But you know what I mean? Like it has like a light frivolity to it, but it's the songwriting is just like at a higher clip, I think.
It's not so much that the album all is the same. I just think there's certain elements that go through the whole thing that make it make a little more sense than Montevallo. Yeah. Like Montevallo like had these like super kind of like whimsical up-tempo things that really didn't have any of that like hip hop element to them. And then other ones where it's like totally like out there, like single for the summer, you know, like, so it's just like, he was definitely like playing in all these different areas. Whereas with Southside, it's like we were talking about, the singles make more sense in the whole because like there's this thing, not only the like kind of the underlying syncopated pulse, but also just the way that it's recorded is sort of a little casual, you know, like ever so slightly like rough around the edges in a way that's really appealing, you know, and that ties all the different sounds like the R&B and the like bluegrass one and the whatever, you know, that makes them all sound kind of coherent together.
And it's also like true to his process because he's not necessarily working in the same studios that most of the Nashville folks are working in. You know, Zach Crowell has a home studio. They have a little setup there. There's like not even like a blanket around the microphone section. Now, obviously, they clean it up a little bit after that, but the kind of raw stuff happens in a much more casual space than a lot of the Nashville stuff does. And I agree. The thing that Sam does well is, I think, because of his range of influences, his vocal approaches, even on the more traditional material, don't feel so crisp and like tied and like, T's crossed and I's dotted. Right. Like there is like a touch of ambiguity in his delivery. I feel like country's hostile to that sometimes.
Yeah, I think so. He's definitely a little more neutral, but he's still got that slight twang to, you know, really like keep it in the country loop. But we were going to talk about Nothing Lasts Forever, right?
Oh, yes. Go in. Speak it. Speak on it.
You know, that line, like, say it's something, just don't say it's nothing because nothing lasts forever. Like, what do you even do about that? It's like, okay, Sam, I'm already dead. Like, stop shooting. You
know? Yeah. I feel almost silly kind of reading Sam Hunt lyrics because they make me like a sweaty. Like, they're good. You know what I mean? Like, they're really good. They're smart. They're military precise. They're deployed so carefully. There's a husk in the voice. The heft of them, the emotional heft, the structural crispness, it's just a lot. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like when he's on, he is on. Like holy what, he is on. I mean, honestly, I felt that way about 2016. I mean,
no, for sure.
Oh my God. I need to pull up some lyrics real fast.
It's like, also there's some lines in that one though, where it's like, if anybody else were seeing it, you're like, lol, you know, like I'd take some girls out of my phone. Like, oh, right. Sam, cry me a river.
Right. But he really, but he means it.
I know. He totally, of course he does. He's Sam Hunt. Like he's means everything he's ever said, but
let me read you. In fact, let me read you. Cause I quoted these lyrics in my piece. I put the whiskey back in the bottle, put the smoke back in the joint, look up at the sky and say, okay, 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 think you made your point. Oh!
Yeah, it's like, it's emo king Sam Hunt.
Oh, it's so good. So when I went to Nashville to talk to him this most recent time, I think it was CRS week, the Country Radio Seminar week. Mm-hmm. And as you know, every label like has a showcase where they parade everybody. And unlike in other genres where like you could never get people to do like one song at 1 p.m. for a bunch of radio programmers on a lineup with 20 other artists, in country, people show up and the stars do it. And I saw Carrie Underwood come and like belt out a song in the middle of the day. But Sam Hunt came and he did this song. And he did it like super stripped down, just him and maybe one other guitar player. Maybe there were two. I can't remember. But he did it super stripped down. And I had not heard it previously. And I was blown away. So blown away. It was so good. And for a minute, I was like, oh, my God, is he going to do like a traditional record? Like, is he going to do like a trad record? Is this whole album?
And he had said that, right? He had sort of alluded to that in the run-up, you know, like, because obviously we've been waiting for this for 5 million years. And in, like, ooh, some of the interviews, he would be like, yeah, I'm, like, doing more of a traditional thing, much to the chagrin of a blog. I don't know if we're going to, like, say its name, but.
If you know, you know.
If you know, you know. I mean, to me, opening with that specific song feels like a little bit of a the haters kind of thing, right? I shouldn't have sworn, but like,
no, that's quite all right. That's quite all right. But I do think that's right. I also, so there's two parts to this, right? One is I think that Sam is someone who is very cognizant of the conversation around him. And I think he's been very careful to kind of calibrate his output, like almost like triangulate it with the conversation, you know, like to know like where, how am I being perceived? How can I both lean into that in the positive sense, but also push back against that in a productive way? So I do agree, like putting this song first is very much like, oh, you don't think I'm about this life? Right. Let me show you what I'm really about. That's number one. The other thing is, I think this song is very much a hard emotional reset that's almost like a hidden handshake between him and his wife. I think it's like, I'm going to make this the first song on the record. It's going to be like a table clearing song. It's going to be very obvious what it's about the transition from my old life to my new life, about the ways that I fell short. And then it's going to free me up to then go back to being Sam Hunt, in quotes, but I'm going to do this as kind of a table clearer. That's how it feels to me. I did not get to speak to Hannah, unfortunately, for my piece. I did ask. And Drinking Too Much, you know, which had come out a long time ago and is the last song on the record. That to me is like the beginning of the secret handshake. And then 2016 is like the end of the secret handshake.
That's another thing that really, really sets it apart from Montevallo is like, that album is like very upbeat, fun, flirtatious. Like, yes. I'm hitting on all these women, whatever. Like, even like Take Your Time is like ultimately like a hollering song. It's just like a very serious hollering song.
Wait, let's listen to Take Your Time. Wait. Let's everybody get a personal fan and put some cold air on yourself. Let's listen to a little bit of Take Your Time. Let's get a little sweaty.
I feel attacked by this introduction to the song, but whatever.
That's fine. That's an accurate attack. Here's Take Your Time.
And I know it starts with hello, and the next thing you know, you try to be nice, and some guy's getting too close, trying to pick you up, trying to get you to run. And I'm sure one of your friends is about to come over here, cause she's supposed to save you from random guys that talk too much and wanna stay too long. It's the same old song and dance, but I think you know it well.
So it's like all these like kind of hollering, partying, upbeat, whatever songs. And this album is mostly about like regret and longing.
Yes.
You know, even though it does have some upbeat songs, like even the upbeat songs are about breakups.
We should definitely say get you a man or a woman who will write songs about you like Drinking Too Much and 2016. I am sure that it was difficult to convince Hannah to come back into his life when he was at the peak of his fame. I am sure these songs seem like about as good an argument for I'm going to be a mega famous country star. And I also can deliver emotionally resonant music that pleases the love of my life. I think that is
get you a guy that can do both, right?
That's a real, real thing. So I just it's very exciting. But that said, I think you were right when we were talking about the kind of interstitial singles that had come previously, Body Like a Back Road, especially Body Like a Back Road and Downtown's Dead. There is a kind of like neutrality to them, right? Like there is a kind of swimming in place aspect to it.
Body Like a Back Road is just so like blah. Like just as far as what it talks about, it's like the most like kind of cringy, like it's not actually offensive, but it's just kind of like it just makes me personally like just gag a little bit. And I'm not opposed to like Sam Hunt doing like sexy stuff. Like I love Speakers so much, like I'm obsessed with that song, but Body Like a Back Road just feels so like I don't know, like viscerally I'm like no. And Downtown's Dead I like more in the context of the album than I did on its own, but it's definitely like an in-between song and not a standout banger. So it's a little interesting to me that they were chosen to be put out there.
Not to get too deep into the TikTok of how the Sam piece came together, but you know, I had been working on the Sam piece in 2016 and 2017. 2016 trying to make it happen when it still seemed like that record was coming, and then 2017 is when we did the first set of interviews. Mm-hmm. So when they went dark, you know, when they went, obviously, I'm sort of like having anxieties. I was like, oh, no, where's the story? The story's not happening. But I started, you know, looking more closely when he would post on Instagram, and like every little trickle of information started to like take on all this extra meaning. And I remember at that time thinking he is not worrying about putting music out. And that was so clear because I would see, you know, he posts this photo of him and I don't know if they were married yet, but his fiance or his wife traveling in, you know, Israel or Vietnam or wherever they were. This man is not putting any songs out. But then there's like the responsible side of him where I think he was like, well, we're going to go on tour this summer and we should probably have a new single if we're going to go on tour. Those things felt like concessions. They did not feel like the bold statements that I would ordinarily expect from him. The striking thing that I took away from the interviews was his low-key anxiety or stress about Old Town Road and kind of what happens when Sam Hunt, the innovator, actually is taking a step back from innovation. That was really striking to me, because one of the things that he talked about was, you know, he had sessions with Charlie Handsome, who's done some Post Malone stuff and Travis Scott stuff. He had sessions with Diplo. He had sessions with Murder Beats, trying to identify a path that could take the ideas of Montevallo and really do something fully formed. And him talking about Old Town Road and being like, ah, damn, they kind of hit on something that maybe I had not yet hit on. And I thought he was very earnest and willing to be vulnerable about having made slightly more conservative choices in the last year as he was putting this record together, and wanting his next cycle to be the more experimental, forward-looking period.
Honestly, I feel like this record is more experimental than Montevallo. You know, like, I think there are risks that he took here that he wasn't taking then. And I almost like appreciate that we don't have the like Diplo produced tracks, because Diplo is putting out country tracks right now. You know, there's that Morgan Wallen one. I know. The Cam one was okay, but like the Morgan Wallen one, and I am a Morgan Wallen aficionado.
Who can relate? I just, even the mere mention of that, I just feel like I need an Excedrin at the mere mention of the Diplo country record.
You know what I mean? Like, I think This Way is better, because it's like, they're still doing cool like stuff that is pushing the envelope in a very Nashville way, which is to say not all that much. But I don't know. To me, it just seems like, I like the statement that this record is making, like, because this is bringing in like banjo and fiddle and whatever, like all that stuff on top of these beats. And it sounds really seamless. You know, you don't hear the edges, you know, you don't hear the borders.
And also, first of all, I have to say it on podcast, because I wrote it in the piece. We were listening to Hard to Forget at the beginning, and that when I first heard that, immediately my brain said, "Yo, brother, where art thou?" Which I was really proud of.
I
Googled to make sure that no person had ever used that phrase before in any other context. And I think no one has. So I'm pretty sure that's me. I'm pretty sure I did that.
Congratulations.
You're welcome.
Wow.
That's a global you, not just a you. That's a global you. What you just said reminds me of something that Cindy Mabe, who is the label president, said, which, when she first said it to me, I almost like didn't even hit for me until I went back and listened to the record again after I had spoken with her, where she was like, this is his most progressive record and also his most traditional record. Now, to be fair, he only has two albums, so it's not like we're talking about 10 albums here. But the idea that he is pushing at both sides in both directions at the same time, I think is very real. And I think true to the kind of identity crisis of the last few years for Sam, because I know we didn't really, and I didn't really get into this in the piece, but I know he's like very curious about artists like Sturgill and people like that. And he listens to a lot of bluegrass, and he's really fascinated about how he can absorb some of those approaches and aesthetics into what he does. So that's in him, and that's what he's trying to do. But also, he is the number one most thoughtful, forward thinking genre mashup guy in Nashville. So how do you do both at the same time?
Any anxiety he might have about Old Town Road, like Old Town Road, incredible song, obviously, like your defining song. But like, we don't know that Lil Nas X is going to come through, you know, like this. It was one.
We know.
OK. All right. I haven't seen convincing proof that like all of country music is going to change because of Lil Nas X.
I'm just saying we know that he's not going to come through with anything.
I see what you mean. So I'm just saying, it's like, this is it's not a better or worse thing, but it's like, this is a fully formed idea, especially on this album, you know?
Oh, and absolutely.
It's like, I was just really impressed by the kind of detail orientedness of the way that it was all kind of crafted together, which I didn't get from the singles. Like I said, the singles felt so haphazard. And then in the album, it's not like that.
I do think the rollout of the singles has been, like I said, a little bit of like placeholdery, certainly the prior singles prior to Kinfolks. It's almost like he's drawing like some kind of like distribution curve, and he's like inching his way towards the risky stuff. It's like, I'm going to give you Body Like a Back Road. I'm going to give you Downtown's Dead. It's like,
Kinfolks is like the most house party of the songs. you know.
Yes, right. And right. So that's like I'm inching back to the Montevallo stuff. It's a little bit better than that, but it's still not going to like offend it. Like no one's going to push back on it. Then I'm going to give you Hard to Forget. It starts with a Webb Pierce sample, but then it turns into like a boom bap record. So it's like no matter which part of Sam Hunt you're into, you're getting that. And then you set up the rest of the record, and the rest of the record, like you say, accomplishes both sounds, both approaches that Sam is so good at, I think. I'm grateful that this record exists, but I'm also like particularly excited because I think if he can take some of those ideas, you know, he could have a Bubba Sparks Deliverance on his hands, which is something that we did not talk about. But I think he could have a Deliverance on his hands, which is, you know, to me, probably like the defining hip hop record with country influence of all time. Mm-hmm. Did you just you got nothing?
I
mean, for
I'm excited to see that happen. I don't know. I feel like I want to see that. I don't know if he'll go there. You know, maybe he will, maybe he won't. You know, I think it's kind of hard to say at this juncture. You talk about in your piece sort of how personal all the songwriting is. And yeah, clearly he's like a perfectionist. You know, he has the D'Angelo syndrome for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, 1,000%.
So it's just like to see, you know, artists who are in that mold, you know, like I think it can be like particularly, I don't know, it's maybe more unusual for them to take those super bold leaps, but I like this album a lot and I think it works well. So
something I didn't really get into in the piece, but I think speaks to what you just said. I was talking to him about those sessions that he had with other producers. And also he was working with that guy, Breland, who has a My Truck record that's been doing pretty well. And Breland's background is primarily in R&B songwriting. You know, he's not worked in the country space at all. And one of the things that Sam said that I thought was really interesting was he was talking about the logistical challenges of working cross genre. You know, he was like, you know, country music sessions, they start at 9, they end at noon. They start at 1, they end at 5. It's a very rigid system. And if you are working with your normal country music folks, you know, Josh Osborne, Shane McAnally, the people who are writing with Sam, that's where they're working. They're, you know, it's a job. You're checking in, you're checking out. The people who make the kinds of records that I think Sam is interested to try or to see if he can like extract something from do not work in that way. And Sam is molded by the country tradition. Even though his influences are very vast, his logistical framework is the country framework.
Well, he's also trying to be that guy, right? He's trying to be a married guy, have kids and
yes,
whatever,
well, that too, you know, so. Of course. And he also said that it's also tougher to have the freedom to make risky choices now that he is married. You know, he was very transparent. Not all of this got into the piece, but he was very transparent about this. One of the things I was really grateful for was he didn't kind of sugarcoat it. He was just like, I'm not that single guy anymore. He's like, you know, me and my wife, we live together and like that's my wife and this is what we do. And yes, do I stay up sometimes and like learn bluegrass licks and like try to like do, you know, like absorb music at 1 a.m. and like record little notes to myself for ideas? Yes. But basically, you know, he's working a job and he's pretty straightforward about that. But the logistical, like what it would take if he was going to go in the studio with a Charlie Handsome or somebody like that for like 2 weeks to really try to like suss out an idea, that's hard. It's hard to carve out that time from the country perspective. It's hard to lock in that time from the hip hop perspective. And it's hard to get the hip hop informed producers to work on your schedule because that's just not what that ecosystem is like. So that the logistical challenges was something he talked about and also his producer Zach talked about that makes some of these potential outcomes a little bit tougher to get to.
I feel like we need to talk about That Ain't Beautiful. At least at some point.
I knew this was coming. All right, we'll go out on That Ain't Beautiful, but let's talk about it before we go out on it.
Look, Sam Hunt, who I basically adore, I don't think that's news to anyone on this podcast. He has some Drake tendencies, you know. Yes. Drake is a person who I struggle a lot with.
I do not struggle personally with Drake. And I also have Drake-like tendencies. So I just, that's, you know.
Okay. Well, you don't have that many Drake-like tendencies because we're friends. So, but no, Drake has a specific way of being sexist that's like really patronizing. And it just drives me up a wall. You know, like a lot of music is sexist, but Drake's particular brand is like, it's not something I can tolerate. And Sam, sometimes he veers a little close to that. And we see it on Drinking Too Much, sort of. You know, he's kind of in this like emo confessional spoken word mode. You know, that's very Drake-y Sam Hunt.
Truly also, his most Drake record.
Right. And but also like tonally, this song, That Ain't Beautiful, is like extremely Drake. Like he's lamenting this woman who I can totally picture. It's a very vivid description. And I'm not saying this woman doesn't exist, but it's like this superficial woman who like does all this dumb stuff. And, you know, he's just like, that ain't beautiful. That ain't you. That's his response to this woman making like poor decisions. Okay, well, who cares what you think is beautiful, Sam Hunt? Sorry. But also, like, I don't hate it completely, but, like, from a philosophical perspective, it really upsets me. But, like, the song itself is not terrible, and I understand that it's, like, well-intentioned, so.
I will say, like, it's the only song on this album where the lyrics are so brusque as to almost, like, take you out of the moment, because he's always inhabiting a bit of a character, but the character isn't so overtly tisk-tisky as it is on this song.
Yeah, that's true.
And when I heard the record for the first time, top to bottom, it kind of took me out a little bit, because I was like, it's like you're having to do the mental recalibration of like, okay, is this the same Sam that was on the previous song? And if so, why is this that Sam sound this way for the last seven songs, but doesn't sound like that on this song? One thing that he told me is that he had a little bit of a concern about this record, and he was considering putting an extra verse on the end that sort of like kind of like softened it a little bit, like kind of like brought it home a little bit, but ultimately decided that the tone of it was being consistent throughout was kind of a successful artistic choice. So ended up not doing it. I also think probably running out of time near the end of the cycle to get the record done. But I think it was on his mind as well. But it is, I agree, it does have a little bit of that Drake-like tendency that you're talking about. But I think the thing that was perhaps more jarring for me was hearing Sam Hunt, who is usually like lamenting his own failings or flirting, or it's very rarely looking at a woman and saying, you're doing this thing wrong.
Yeah.
Or this thing is not, you know what I mean? Like, that's not part of his thing.
Also, like, it's just him crooning, you can split an Adderall with a stranger in a bathroom stall. That line is like, he's like crooning it so sweetly, and it just cracks me up.
Yes, that's fair. Wait, what if he's the stranger?
Maybe. And like, also, like, when he's like, because being treated like shit is really comfortable to you, I'm like, okay, wow. All right, you got me, Sam. You got me. Yeah, but
and also Sam cursing on this record. There's at least two curses on this record.
Right, just right. Sidebar. I know, it's at like, two curses. Country music, saying shit. How dare he?
And I think the jarring thing for me was hearing him kind of like tisting, potentially judging someone who, ultimately the song is like, I don't know if it's an affectionate song, but it's a song about someone he feels warmly towards. But the path to that was a little bit disruptive.
Yes, it's an interesting moment. Definitely an aberration from the rest of the catalog.
So let's go out with a little bit of the aberration. This is That Ain't Beautiful. Natalie, thank you so much for continuing to ride the Sam Hunt train with me.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
If that ain't beautiful, no, that ain't you. You can do better. Oh, you can do better, better.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover-Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I gave my brother a New York Times subscription.
She sent me a year-long subscription, so I have access to all the games. We'll do Wordle, Mini, Spelling Bee.
It has given us a personal connection.
We exchange articles.
And so having read the same article, we can discuss it.
The coverage, the options, it's not just news.
Such a diversified gift.
I was really excited to give him a New York Times cooking subscription so that we could share recipes. And we even just shared a recipe the other day.
The New York Times contributes to our quality time together.
You have all of that information at your fingertips.
It enriches our relationship, broadening our horizons.
It was such a cool and thoughtful gift.
We're reading the same stuff. We're making the same food. We're on the same page.
Connect even more with someone you care about.
Learn more about giving a New York Times subscription as a gift
at nytimes.com/gift.
Coronavirus is still on and popping and very much happening. We are still doing remote recording. We're still doing Verite podcasts. I'm still in the crib. I'm still in the home office. As promised, I have turned around to the shelves behind me and pulled something off the shelf, and we're going to talk about it for a minute. So I just yanked a couple records out, and the one that fell to the floor, this is actually kind of a good one. Okay, so let's talk about the backpack rap of the mid to late 90s. When I used to write about hip hop in the late 90s, this is when I lived in London. I would come back and I would run around to record labels and have meetings with folks. I spent a lot of time up at the Raucous office. This is I talk about dragging yourself. This is the thing I did a lot. So shouts to Black Sean, RIP Devin Roberson. So you spent a lot of time at the Raucous office. It was probably one of the first promo lists that I got on with that, where I got stuff with regularity. I remember getting this record that I'm holding in my hand and kind of not knowing what to make of it. But in retrospect, it was a pretty savvy thing because I was living, again, and I know for everybody who's playing the drinking game, I was living in London, so I was exposed to a fair amount of drum and bass at the time. I used to go to Metalheads at the Blue Note, and a lot of those clubs when I wrote for Trace Magazine. So Raucous had a sub-label. It was called Raw Cuts, K-U-T-S. And I don't think it lasted very long, but they did put out a pretty good drum and bass remix of Oh No. Oh No was a song. It was Mos Def, Nate Dogg, Pharoah Monch. And they put out a 12 that had two different drum and bass remixes of it. John B was the producer, not that John B, the other John B. So the record I just pulled off the shelf is the one with the smooth drum and bass mix on one side and the heavyweight drum and bass mix on the other side. So this is a great moment in indie rap and jungle crossover history. Let's listen to a little bit of Oh No, heavyweight drum and bass mix.
Oh No.
Shifting directions, we are going to talk in the second half of podcast this week about Kenny Rogers. Kenny Rogers passed away last month at 81, and Kenny was one of the signature pop country crossover stars, really of all time, but certainly from the late 70s into the 80s and into the 90s. Bill Friskix Warren is calling in from Nashville. Bill, what's going on?
Hey, John. Sunny weather, finally.
Well, that's one small positive in an otherwise generally traumatic time in American history. Yes. Bill wrote the obituary for Kenny Rogers for the Times. He's been writing for writing obituaries of country music stars for the paper for 20 years, been writing about country music longer than that. I'm very happy to have Bill here to kind of talk about Kenny's career, his impact, and how he had been perceived during his career. And also I want to talk about how that changed over time, how the sort of retrospective look of him kind of evolved. Bill, there was a quote that was in your obituary from an old Kenny interview that I was really struck by, where he said something to the effect of the reason he chose his approach to country, pop friendly, gentle, almost fatherly, was not so much because he was reacting to other modes of country in terms of genre choice, but more that he felt he should do what he could do that nobody else could do. And he didn't feel that he could do a better Johnny Cash than Johnny Cash, do a better Waylon than Waylon, but he could do this and he could do this better than anybody else was doing it. That really struck me. Tell me about that take. I was actually curious if that was something that he felt in 1977 and 1980 and 1983, or if it's something that you learn over the years when you look back on your choices. Based on your reading of Kenny's career, what do you think?
I think it was a looking back on his part, and also his coming to terms with peace with being a musical omnivore, someone like a Glen Campbell, who is at home in multiple genres and is engaged by them and just doesn't see there to be dividing lines between this mode of expression and this one.
And now, at the time that Kenny was really arriving at his peak, so we want to say, you know, the late 70s into the early to mid 80s, how did Kenny relate to the center of Nashville? Because one thing that we know from writing about country music for years and years and years is that there is always a tug of war happening between people who ostensibly occupy the center of the genre, even though that is always a troubled framing. But there is always a tug of war between that and people who are doing something that is different or to the left or more pop focused, or, you know, in the case of Sam Hunt, who we were talking about earlier in the episode, more hip hop focused. At the time, was what Kenny was doing perceived as radical or challenging or even disruptive?
I don't think so. You know, think about folks like, you know, Don Williams and Crystal Gayle, who were on the radio at the same time. You've got the outlaw stuff going on as well with Waylon and Willie and those folks. But by the time Kenny hit it with Lucille and the Gambler in the getting to be late 70s, we're inching toward urban cowboy. And so, you know, Mickey Gilley was big at this period. There was room, I think, for the pop country. In fact, it chagrined someone like Charlie Rich, who, you know, famously lit his Entertainer of the Year card with the CMAs that year on fire. I think he was supposed to say that Olivia Newton-John had won Entertainer of the Year, or maybe it was John Denver. I don't recall. But,
you know, is that true? I don't actually know if I knew that.
Yeah. I mean, Peter Grounick had documented it really well in his book, Feel Like Going Home.
Charlie Rich not having it.
No. And well, he'd had a lot as well. Yeah. So he was pretty inebriated.
And also you mentioned, you know, just Crystal Gayle, and it's interesting. I've sort of spent some time in the last couple of weeks thinking about the beginnings of my own engagement with country, especially coming from New York, not growing up in it. But I remember very vividly, Crystal Gayle was popular enough that my mother and my father had Crystal Gayle albums. I have like very clear memories of in their vinyl collection, like in addition to the ABBA records and the Pointer Sister records and the Chic records, you know, like sort of standard 70s soul and pop stuff. I have very vivid memories of Crystal Gayle records because her hair was so long. So it stuck in my head all these years. And I remember us listening to those records. And that was really probably my entree into country music, not even knowing that that's what it was. But Kenny obviously coming at a very similar moment to that. We also should probably at least just nod to kind of the Countrypolitan stuff from, you know, a decade to two decades earlier. It's not as if like the first genteel balladeering coming out of Nashville was done by Kenny Rogers.
You're very right about the Countrypolitan paving the way in some ways for Kenny Rogers and again, Don Williams, Crystal Gayle, those records that people like Sammy Smith and Tammy Wynette and George Jones were making with people like Billy Sherrill.
Rest in peace, Billy Sherrill.
Yeah, yeah. But there's definitely a kinship and a continuity between the Countrypolitan sound that kind of has some roots in Southern soul music, but in that kind of balladeering that features songs that are about adult concerns like making ends meet, staying faithful.
Yeah, straying, infidelity, yeah, for sure. Infidelity. So, yeah. We can listen to Kenny Rogers hits all day long, but we should probably just skip right to the money, and that's the Gambler.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
You got a thing that is very striking to me about the Gambler in retrospect is the way that that song spread and was marketed feels very modern. because it's there's The Gambler and then there's movies. There's, you know, it becomes this kind of touchstone for all these other forms of cultural production. And it had real legs. I talked about this, I think, last week, or I think it was last week on podcast, but like during the first quarantine weekend when D Nice was doing his Instagram live DJ set and he played a Kenny Rogers tribute set, when he played The Gambler, the comments went crazy. And this is in a fundamentally like an R&B and hip hop set, but everybody who was there knows The Gambler. The Gambler was a cross genre hit. It was a cross platform hit. It feels, like I said, it reminds me of kind of how songs aspire to be marketed now. But back then, it felt radical at the time. Did it seem, to your recollection, was it working harder? Was it spreading more quickly or more wildly than other kind of similar hits of its day?
I think it was. And I think a lot of it had to do with Kenny Rogers' persona, how it easily it lent itself to various media. You know, he could step into an acting role very naturally. He really reminds me a lot of kind of the country stars of old, when touring would include a devotional number, you know, a comedy type themed number, something upbeat that maybe demonstrated some instrumental prowess, and then, you know, some balladeering. And in some ways, I think of a guy like Brad Paisley today, putting all those things together, being something of an inheritor of Kenny Rogers, someone who isn't worried about what's going to be perceived as cool, but what entertains and what he enjoys doing.
Yeah, that's interesting. The kind of the idea that the job of the singer really does extend past the song. It does extend to entertaining. It's funny because I think we take that for granted now, but there are still some contemporary singers who just aren't that good at that. They're like good singers. Maybe they're good song interpreters, or they're good dancers, or even good vocalists and songwriters. But the entertainment part of it isn't always there. Kenny was someone who I think got that from the very jump. That seemed like that was always key to him. Tell me a little bit about how his music evolved and grew throughout the kind of like post-Gambler period, like into the early to mid 80s.
Yeah, well, you know, and a parallel there is kind of like Willie Nelson at that time, too, after Stardust, just being able to sing whatever he wants. I'm really impressed to learn, or was impressed to learn while preparing his obituary, that the Bee Gees originally wrote Islands in the Stream for Marvin Gaye.
Oh, my.
So that could translate so seamlessly, who apparently said, no thanks. But that could translate so seamlessly to Kenny and Dolly doing what is just an exhilarating performance that almost feels transgressive. It's so ecstatic.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're really, I mean, I know it's maybe trite to say it, but like they're really in step with each other.
Yeah.
Not all duets are like that. It sets a very, very high bar for the texture of a duet in my mind. We should probably listen to some of the harmony parts in Islands in the Stream, because man, I mean, you know, not to be an old person, but they just do not make them like this anymore. I mean, this is just some nuts stuff happening on here. All right, let's listen to a little bit of Islands in the Stream.
Islands in the Stream, that is what we are.
Think like those kind of duets were like obviously much more in vogue at the time. You know, they've kind of come in and out of favor in pop over the decades, but they were like very much in vogue. And I think part of the reason that Kenny was so good at them is he had this capacity to be incredibly vocally evocative, but not in any way overpowering. He's never trying to like stomp on a song. He's achieving a lot with really just a little bit of movement, kind of like gestural stuff more than anything. And that really opens up space to be able to sing with a partner.
Absolutely. And I think, too, his roots in gospel music are key here. The, you know, the call and response. He said in interviews how he really, once he learned what harmony vocals were, he really almost preferred that to singing the lead, because it gave him an opportunity to be creative and to stretch. But it was also just an expression of that gospel call and response.
Talk a little bit about how Kenny Rogers' success changed the perception of country music in the mainstream in the 1980s.
Well, in some ways, by the mid 80s, when Kenny might have been at his peak in terms of presence on the charts, video, touring, movies and all, mainstream country went kind of traditional with the neo-traditional movement with, you know, Randy Travis and Dwight Yoakam and singers like that. And although a lot of Kenny's stuff has that somewhat of a traditional feel of a folk song kind of quality to it, I think that Nashville was turning a little bit away from where he had taken things by mid-decade.
I hadn't necessarily thought about that neo-traditional surge, you know, mid to late 80s. I was thinking more of the kind of what comes after that, you know, Alan Jackson, Brooks and Dunn. Like, I was thinking of that as a reaction to Kenny, but you're right. There is this kind of transition in between those two where the neo-traditional music that was being made by those folks was so grounded historically, but to my ears, like, a lot of it was still kind of genteel. It didn't have that brawn, and I always think of the brawn being the reaction to Kenny, but I think you're right that that kind of like groundedness really is part of the reaction that you see, not rescuing but throwing a hook into country and trying to pull it back in another direction.
It's interesting though how these things cycle around. You've got these folks who are seeking that groundedness who probably are saying, what's Kenny Rogers doing with Sheena Easton or Kim Carnes or Gladys Knight or James Ingram? These aren't our typical collaborators. And yet by the 90s, Nashville was putting out country and soul records that had Wynonna Judd singing with Sam Moore of Sam and Dave and those kind of pairings. And so I think one of the things Kenny Rogers did was blow things open such that anything could go, you know, if there was there were the horses to drive it.
Now, look, there's so many jams that we could go out with. I want to encourage everybody. First of all, we're not going to go out with Lady, but I do want to say that Lady is so sterling. It's so good. And it's so stark. It could almost weirdly be like an off Broadway one man show about desolation and dismal sadness. It's so intense. It's a tactile level of intensity. So everybody, please go listen to Lady, written by Lionel Richie, recorded by Kenny. But Bill, what's a kind of slept on Kenny hit for us to go out with that people might not be up on?
Kenny in the first edition, you know, Ruby.
Okay.
Don't Take Your Love to Town. I mean, just the interpretive range he demonstrates on that, inhabiting the agony of this disabled veteran as he watches who's also impotent and who watches his wife go downtown to meet men.
Right.
And kind of the murder that's in his heart. It's just pretty breathtaking if you settle into
it. Yeah. Also like just real good OG country song, story song, like the, you know what I mean? Like the depth of the depth of emotion, but also the kind of intricacy of narrative that I think you don't see as much anymore, you know, especially once country got to the point, you know, you'd had the kind of like tripartite song craft of like, it's three different versions on the same theme. You didn't really have these kind of intense story songs quite as frequently, but this is a gem. So let's definitely go out with this. It's Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town, Kenny Rogers in the first edition. Bill, appreciate you calling in. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
John, I don't mean to interrupt you and Bill, but I do have a quick story to tell.
Yeah, man. Yo, to interrupt away.
I got to say, Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town, the first edition song, that is one of those songs that you just never forget. It's a great song.
Bad record. Bad. Good, bad. Bad meaning
absolutely
good.
A bad record. That was a song my mom had a tendency when we were kids to ban us from listening to songs. And that was one of the songs.
Oh,
that
wow.
That was it. It was that. Sol Makossa for some strange reason.
Wow. And, you know, rest in peace. R.I.P. Mano Dubango. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. R.I.P. Mano Dubango. But
for real.
That is just a great song, man.
It really is. And shouts to your mom for trying to delimit your cultural absorption as a child. And we, you know, here on Popcast, we told her.
Yes, we did. Yes, we
told
did.
Her. Yes, we did. So as we go out, this is for Pedro's mom. Thanks, Natalie Weiner. Thanks to Bill Frisk-Warren. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Get involved with the Facebook group. Seek it out. It's jumping. I can't keep up with it. The podcast Facebook listener group. Email me your favorite secret Sam Hunt song or live performance at popcastnytimes.com. I want to know where all the gems are, but let me know where the gems are. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Apple, etc., etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.
Don't take your love to town. It was
wasn't me that started that old crazy Asian world.